We're talking with St. John Hunt about the confessions of his father, E. Howard Hunt, about the JFK assassination. We've got a couple of the names that E. Howard Hunt gave to his son, those who were involved. When we come back, additional names, and then at the bottom of the hour, I'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions. So stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. So when you got a guy like E. Howard Hunt, who's spent his entire life telling fibs, misleading the public. I mean, that was his job to a large extent, spreading disinformation, spreading cover stories, telling lies to a large extent. And he's told, as outlined in this book by St. John Hunt, Bond of Secrecy, he's told a lot of different versions about his role in this. He's denied any involvement, has told different stories about where he was, stories that don't always hold up. How do you know, St. John, that the story you got from your dad is the real deal?
Well, bottom line there, George, is the story that started on, that unfolded as my dad was telling it to me, it never was completely told. He passed away before he could detail more of it. What he told me was enough. I feel in my heart of heart that in the many sessions that my dad and I had, that here was a man that was finally divesting himself of this information. And you're very correct in saying that he was a professional liar. I mean, this whole was, you know, based around lies and misinformation, disinformation, and all that. And certainly I felt that there was a good deal of that, even in the fact that we as his children were in a very twisted sense, just part of a cover story. You know, how genuine was this man's love for his children? Would he have wanted to have kids had it not been so important as part of his cover? You know, these are things that that I really can't answer and will always remain a mystery. But in those last year of his life, when we sat one on one and I sat at his bedside, he, in my heart of hearts, my gut feeling was he was starting to unfold the truth to me. He was telling me the truth about what happened to JFK, that he was brought into this inner circle, and his expertise was requested. Some of the people that that he was told were involved, he told me some of those names, and I feel that at that very, very late stage in his life, at the end of his life, that this was in fact as close to a deathbed confession as anyone could ever get.
So tell us what it is. Tell us the names, and start it with this. Do you know who kicked it off? I mean, you mentioned LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover had reasons to want him dead. The mob wanted him dead. The anti-Castro Cubans wanted him dead. Elements of the CIA, some big industrialists and oil men wanted him dead. But where did the impetus come from, or do you know?
Well, what he told me, and without giving it entirely away, because I would like the readers to, I mean, your listeners to read the book, to, you know, to get a good complete account of how this was for me. Because like you said in the beginning, this is not just a book of factoids and information about the JFK assassination or Watergate. This is a very personal story involving very human emotion and elements that are missing in a lot of in almost every other book about the JFK assassination. I'm sorry if I'm sounding a little it's 5 o'clock, almost 5 o'clock in the morning here in Florida.
Understood.
Yeah,
Understood.
and I'm sitting out here in my car so I can get the reception that you need for the show. But anyways, he told me in the very beginning that he got word was gotten to him from his elements of the CIA that there would be his presence was requested at a safe house here in Miami, and he thought nothing of it and attended this meeting. Well, at this meeting, they were outlining a plan to the assassination of somebody in this country, and at that time, he did not know who the person was, but the code name for the operation was the Big Event, and that's how he referred to it as from this point on. He said that it had come to their attention that there was, in fact, several operations to remove this politician in the United States, and they were running concurrently with each other. There was a location that was being considered in Florida. There was an operation that was being considered in the Midwest, and there was an operation that was being considered at another location. I'm not sure if he told me that location or not. And during these meetings, it turns out that my dad said, "Well, okay, now we've got this location and that location. What do you need me for? And who are we talking about here?" He said that they looked up at him and they said President Kennedy. And my dad said his jaw basically dropped. But he, in all seriousness, he said, "My God, you can't be serious." His Cuban friend there said, "No, we're very serious." And Papa said, "Well, what kind of authorization does this have? I mean, how high up does this go?" And they said, "It goes all the way to the top. It goes all the way to the vice presidency." And the meeting adjourned without any formalities. My dad attended another meeting here in Florida on the campus of the University of Florida, a different safe house location with the same people that were at the first safe house. And the meeting was fleshed out. The assassination was fleshed out a little farther. Now, at this point in the story, my dad told me that he respectfully declined to be involved. He said, "Saint, I was just a bench warmer in this." He goes, "I did know about it, but I just want to assure you that that I was not one of the tramps in Dealey Plaza, and I was not one of the shooters." And over time, I believed him. I felt in my gut that the tramp looked a lot like my dad. I mean, very, very, very much. But he swore to me that it wasn't him. And of course, since that time, there's been, I think, six different tramps that have come out and said, "Well, we were the tramps." And there was only three tramps to begin with. So it's hard to tell what motivates these people to come out and say that they were this or that. But what's interesting to note is that what my dad told me, the involvement of some of the people through other sources can be verified as having the ability, the means, and the motive to undertake such an assassination. There's an afterword in my book by Eric Hamburg, a good friend of mine, and he did some investigation about the things my dad told me regarding the JFK murder and the different players that are mentioned in my book. And it's a very, very solid and very likely scenario with the people that my dad mentioned. You have one guy who was a CIA station chief in Rome, Italy, and he brought in the one of the shooters. There's actually a memo from him, a handwritten memo that's come out through another journalist, saying that we need to use non-American mafia assassins because they can be traced back to the agency. So what we're going to use is assassins from the Marseille area in France through the Italian connection, and that's very doable. There was a London station chief whose wife was having an affair with JFK that wanted to see him removed. There was my father, certainly, who was well known that he couldn't stand had a deep hatred for the Kennedys because of the Bay of Pigs.
There's one name
there
I thought.
The people that were doing the the Group 40, David Sanchez Morales is one guy my father mentioned. He was an assassin that took care of some of the worst kind of things that the CIA does. He was involved.
One name I want to mention for sure is Bill Harvey, and you sort of made a passing reference to it. This guy, he sort of is a linchpin to the whole thing in that he ties together these different groups who had their own gripes with Kennedy, right?
Yeah, that's true. Bill Harvey was a very exotic kind of man. Wore his guns, his 45s, in prominent display, and under alcohol, ranted and raved about getting rid of Kennedy. He was the CIA station chief, I think, in Rome, and he had the connections with the French underground, the heroin underground, that provided what my dad told me was the gunman on the grassy knoll. This gentleman that my dad could not remember exactly the spelling of his name, and so he wrote out in his own hand four letters. It looked like Satie or Sarté or something like that. My dad couldn't actually remember the guy's name, but he said Bill Harvey brought this guy to Dallas as one of the shooters. But here's one thing about my dad that I have to say, and that is my dad never read any of these books on JFK assassination. He could not have cared less of who was writing about what, whether it was a mafia connection or a Johnson connection or a CIA connection. He totally distanced himself from all JFK conspiracy researchers, all JFK information stuff coming out. He didn't want to hear it. He didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to know what the latest books were or what the latest accusations were. This is a subject that he just wanted to have nothing to do with. So the names that he brought to me were names that I hadn't really heard yet. But in looking around now, a couple of these names start cropping up, like this Sarté person or Sarté person. He clearly did not know the name of this person, and there's no way that he picked this name up by reading some JFK assassination book by whomever. This is a name that he barely remembered, but it's close enough to a name of a French underworld, a Corsican underworld figure that was used for assassinations. This guy's name is something like Sarté or Sarté, and he said
Lucien Sarté. Lucien Sarté, who was an assassin for the Corsican mafia and a drug dealer, and who himself was gunned down by Mexican police in a slaying that might have been arranged by CIA years later. a very plausible person to, if you buy the idea that they're going to bring in a European hitman, he's got to be on the short list of who might have been involved.
Yeah. So you know, as my dad is you know, telling me these names, he's kind of struggling to remember who the people were that were talked about at these meetings. And that was one of the names. I think, I mean, in the book, I have photocopies of his handwriting, the chain of command, starting at LBJ, going down through several other names. I'm trying not to give out too much because I'd like people to just get a sense of the whole story rather than just the bare bones of the assassination scenario. But he's got the chain of command written in his own handwriting, and then he's got several pages of handwritten notes that he gave me detailing these meetings at the safe houses, and you know, some other little facts like how he met Frank Sturgis and what role Frank may or may not have played in this. I mean, the documents themselves are pretty amazing when you really take them apart. There's a lot to be told there. My dad did not mince words. He meant the things he said. And when he claims, you know, that he was a bench warmer in this operation, I'm not really sure what he means by that. That leaves a huge mystery still to be investigated. What is that? What did he mean by that? What is?
Well, we know what he didn't do. We know what he didn't do. He didn't come forward and tell anybody about it. You know,
right.
He didn't say, "I'm going to call the police and rat out this thing." He didn't let anybody know.
No, you know, he certainly didn't do that. He was an agency loyalist. I mean, he would not have. You see, the other thing we have to realize is that if my dad wanted to fabricate anything about the JFK assassination, if he wanted to say on his deathbed that this is who did it, he would have never implicated the CIA or any of his comrades if it wasn't the truth. He would have been much easier for him to say, well, it was a KGB plot, or it was a Castro, you know, getting even with John F. Kennedy for the assassination attempts against Castro's life. I mean, there would have been so many other things that he would have said just to shut everybody up and to shift blame away from the CIA, or not entire blame, but at least their involvement, that I know he was telling the truth, because he was such a loyalist to the CIA that it would have been much easier for him to say, well, the truth, son, is that it was a Russian plot, and then that's it. You know, make up some stuff or whatever, or just say that and then die. You know, leave me with that information. Then, for Christ's sake, well, what would I have done? I don't know.
But I think that
he left this huge burden of information on my shoulders, and you know, I was trying to grapple with this this immense story. I ran away from it initially. I'm like, I can't. What do I do with this? My family will hate me for all eternity if I start bringing this out. But my dad's wishes were for me to bring this out after he passed away. He said the only way this can be brought out, St. John, is if you bring this out, my firstborn son, after I pass away, and you have to promise me, swear to me, on your mother, that that you'll wait until I die. And I did. And it was still a little bit of time after that I just didn't know, you know, who am I? I'm not
St. John Hunt. The name of the book is Bond of Secrecy, My Life with CIA Spy and Watergate Conspirator E. Howard Hunt. We come back and open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest about the JFK assassination. We're talking with St. John Hunt about the confessions of his father, E. Howard Hunt, involving the JFK assassination conspiracy. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. our final segment with St. John Hunt. Before going to the phone line, St. John, I want you to tell me about what your life has been like since the book came out. The last time you were here in 2008, I know that you described this in the book. There were attempts to thwart you from getting this information out, lawyers messing with you. Seemed like every step of the way, somebody was trying to stop the story from coming out. I also believe I read that there'd been break-ins at your home, that people had tried to run you off the road. And I know there's family tensions and estrangement there. Describe for us what it's been like since you came out with this information. In one sense, I'm surprised somebody hasn't taken you out.
Well, I think the that's a comforting thought, George. But, I think on the one hand, certainly the way the government operates is rather than face an accusation or deal with a particular situation, one of the ways they've learned to over time is to just ignore a situation, because not to ignore it, one would have to feel that there is some substantial information in that threat, and so to respond to it, to deny it, or to even to say, oh, this is a conspiracy kook, or this is a guy who's trying to make a few bucks off his dad's name. To respond to anything in my book or anybody else's book in the last 10, 15 years, the government is not going to address this situation at any time. And so the best way to deal with it is not to deal with it at all. But for my own safety, when I finally figured out how to get this out, I very clearly over my phone spoke very clearly about having my dad's handwritten notes copied and located in several different locations, and that if anything should happen to me, such as a horrible accident or a disappearance from off the face of the earth, that that there was instructions left with certain individuals to go immediately to the press with this information. I think that was important to do. Yes, my house was broken into, where I was living, ransacked. Nothing was stolen that you would think would be normally stolen at a regular break-in if someone was looking for TV sets or DVDs to steal, some crazed drug user or something like that. But all paperworks in my little office were ransacked and files gotten into. But I had all this stuff triple copied and more, and put in locations nationwide with friends, and there remains still to this day. So I think my safety definitely depended upon those kind of precautions.
We're going to go east of the Rockies. Fletch in Newport, Rhode Island. Good morning, Fletch. You have to speak into the phone. Can't hardly hear you. Hello?
Yes.
You're on the air. Speak up.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What's on your mind?
Yes. I just want to say that I don't think Kennedy was planned on by the CIA in 1960. I think there were probably as many illegal votes for Nixon through the clandestine efforts of the CIA as the mafia for Kennedy. And I think, in essence, that the CIA basically took the country over in 1953 under Nixon and Eisenhower. And Nixon was going to continue the efforts of the CIA takeover. I just want to say what your thoughts on that subject, if the CIA is actually the power behind the country.
Well, I think you have some very strong points. I don't know about any vote scams that were going on for Nixon, but certainly wouldn't rule it out. And as far as the CIA being a major force behind the scenes, I think you're absolutely correct in that, that it certainly didn't start in the 60s, but much, much earlier than that. Certainly under Eisenhower, who, as you know, probably know, warned the country about the military-industrial complex of getting too big to have a standing army as large as we did. I've heard that that he was warning us. Certainly Nixon goes directly back to that time, and of course that brings my dad into the whole picture with the his relationship with Nixon and the CIA and the Group 40, which was the the assassination arm of CIA at the time. So yeah, that's a good point, sir.
Thanks, Fletch, for the call. I should point out also, you look at what the intelligence operations are today, the surveillance state that we have, the power of the NSA to listen to phone calls and tap into your computers and store all that stuff in giant computers, and the willingness of the American public to go along with this stuff. We're basically saying, sure, tap me, listen to my phones, look at my computers. We don't care as long as we're safe. And it's disgusting in a lot of ways. West of the Rockies, Danny Boy in Southern California. Hi, Danny. Hello?
This is Nappy, right? George Nappy.
Am Close enough. Right? What's on your mind?
Oh, got a question for your guest there. My dad did something for the government in World War II that he couldn't say one word about, so I'm probably the son of 007 and a half. Anyway, to make a long story short, there was this guy putting out intelligence newsletters back in the late 70s and early 80s. Said his name was Peter Beter. Said he worked for JFK. And I wondered if your guest has heard of that name, Peter Beter. And he claims that the truth behind the JFK assassination is it was a CIA hit, and they used a remote-controlled bomb to remove part of JFK's head. It was in the back of the seat in front of where he was sitting. That's probably why, if there's any truth to it, that they took him to the hospital, put another brain in him to make it look like Oswald shot him. Anyway, that's just me guessing there. Anyway, what's he got to say about all that? And if you want to look up Dr. Peter Beter's 82 intelligence newsletters on the Internet, they did induce a heart attack in him and killed him off, but his people still got his info on the Internet. Just type in the word Peter Beter and, you know, Google search it. All righty, I'll listen off there. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks for the call, Danny.
Well, I've never heard that name. It's kind of a funny-sounding name, but
yeah.
but I've never heard it before. But as far as JFK being killed by the CIA, by whatever methods, whether this gentleman has information detailing a bomb in the seat, I think he should come forward just as I have and detail any evidence that he may have to support what he's saying. I think that's all of our responsibilities to do as individual citizens is to keep the government in check. And if this is how truth comes out, is in little pieces of a much larger puzzle. And I'm only one person that has a few pieces of a puzzle. I know there's other people out there that have come to me since my book has been published, detailing other pieces of the same puzzle. And sooner or later, we'll get the whole picture. That we need to, and then we'll have to see where that takes us.
First time caller Jake in Alaska. Good morning, Jake.
Hi. Hello?
Hi.
Yes, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Okay, here's what's on my mind. William Cooper was a firm believer in the video that he released on the passenger turning around and firing his shot at JFK. And it was supposedly armed with a shellfish toxin. Now, that's my only question.
Well, Bill Cooper, that video that he basically appropriated from somebody else has been largely discredited. It involves the driver of the vehicle supposedly turning around with a gun and shooting Kennedy. Cooper claimed it for his own. He got it from somebody else. If it's just coming from him, I wouldn't give a whole lot of credence, but I appreciate the call, Jake. Any comments from you, St. John?
Yeah, I think what we have to keep in mind, too, is that part of the government's methodology is to inundate, is to overwhelm the senses of the American public. In other words, I think it wouldn't be too far-fetched to consider that some of the books written about the JFK assassination, some of the information coming out is, in fact, truly authorized to be disinformation, to be misinformation, so that the American public is inundated and overwhelmed with this conspiracy theory, that theory. It's the mob, it's the Cubans, it's the Russians, it's Castro in revenge. It gets to the point where there's such a massive amount of information and theories and books that it's just so overwhelming that it's almost too overwhelming. And so these theories about the guy in the front seat that turns around and all this stuff, I mean, you have to question where this stuff comes from. Like I said, I'm not a JFK researcher. It's not an easy subject for me to talk about. It's really a family thing for me. It's not really primarily out of the need to discover who killed JFK. I think it's obvious that the government had something to do with it. It may or may not have involved, elements of the mafia or Cubans, but one has to question where some of this stuff is coming from and why it's out there. Such a huge amount of information about one moment in time. It's just amazing. It's incredible. So be careful of what you read and what you want to believe. Look behind the sources. What I'm saying in my very small book is just a message that my dad gave to me and a desire for me to bring this out after he passed away. I know nothing more, and I don't make any claims about having any complete answers. I just have a few pieces of the puzzle, which have cost me dearly in my life. To bring out, but that was my duty as his son to do that, and I did it. And from time to time, I'll continue doing it as requested. Certainly, Coast to Coast has been instrumental in helping me carry out his wishes, and I very much appreciate their efforts to do that.
Isn't it astonishing to you, St. John, that this government still has files they won't release? We're coming up on 50 years, and they're still not going to be releasing it now.
Yeah, didn't they say at some point that they would release files like 50 years later, and here we are, and they're not going to release them now? Is that what?
Yeah, I've heard 2017, I've heard 2029. I'm not sure they're ever going to release this stuff.
Yeah, it's like the Roswell thing. It's like, what do they think is going to happen if they release, files pertaining to JFK or the CIA or Roswell, for that matter? The nation's going to just completely go nuts? Or do you think that we can't handle, the truth? I mean, really, it is amazing, George. It's truly, truly mind-boggling the way they treat us like children. And we're just trying to find out the truth. We just want to know the truth. That's all. It's very simple.
I think it has a lot more to do with keeping people out of prison than it does worrying about how the public's going to react. Try to get one more call in on the wild card line. John in Long Beach. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm kind of an amateur detective about this for a long time. I want to mention something real quick. Have you ever heard of a guy named Bill Hunter that was a reporter for the Long Beach Press Telegram? I used to work there myself. I'm a journalist. And apparently a guy named Bill Hunter was from Wichita Falls, Texas, went to Ruby's apartment after he shot Oswald. And then Bill Hunter had a very strange death in the Long Beach police station in the 60s. Allegedly, two cops were playing cops and robbers and dropped the gun and shot him to death. Bill, the name Bill Hunter, much similar to your name. But I have two questions real quick.
Yes, sir.
One is, do you really think that that Oswald had anything to do with it at all? Well, was he really a patsy like he said? And if that's the case, then it's one of the biggest disservices ever done to a person in history. You know, I mean, what do you think about that? And do you think that Lucien Sarkey actually was the guy that pulled the trigger on the Vassy Knoll? Those are my two questions.
Thanks, John.
To answer your second question, I think Lucien Sarkey was almost definitely the shooter on the Grassy Knoll. To answer your first question, I think it is the most gravest disservice to Lee Harvey Oswald and his family, because I truly feel in my heart that Lee Harvey Oswald was innocent of involvement in the JFK assassination. He was what you call a very low-level agent. He was maneuvered and directed in various ways to make himself appear that he was a communist. He was not a communist. He was part of a program that was that Bill Harvey ran for false defectors to the Soviet Union. He was part of that program. That's how he got over there, and that's how he was able to come back, because he was part of an ongoing CIA-sponsored project to send quote-unquote American defectors into the Soviet Union to pick up whatever they could pick up. Now, Oswald was no dummy, but he wasn't in a position where he was a shot caller. And he certainly was no assassin. So my heart goes out to Marina Oswald and her daughters, and to anybody that's related to the Oswalds. I think it's a huge grave disservice to that man's name.
We have about a minute left, St. John. I'm wondering, as the 50th anniversary gets nearer, if the phone is starting to ring, or whether you have any special plans to draw attention to the book and get your story out there.
You know, George, I haven't done I did a lecture down in San Francisco last November, and that was the first time I'd spoken about it for a couple of years. It's really not an easy thing for me to talk about. There's so much personal emotion that has gone into this, and it's still an ongoing hardship for me to continue enduring the problems that it's caused my family, and especially me, for bringing this out. That it's not something I court. I'm not asking anybody to call me. I'm not taking any offers for going to the big Dallas convention in November. I've been asked quite a few times to go there, and it's just not something that's easy for me to talk about. And so this is really a rare opportunity for your listeners to have me on the show. I deeply appreciate it, but it's not, my life really doesn't revolve around this at all. I'm just a normal guy. I've just moved. I have kids and family, and I just trying to live a peaceful life, and I hope that the information I've brought out, what my father did tell me, helps somebody.
Well, it's a
puzzle.
It's a very compelling story. Bond of Secrecy is the book. We did not put a link to your website up, but you do have a website. The reason we didn't is because it indicated there's a malware problem. I think that's probably maybe just somebody messing with you, but it's easy to find your website online if people are interested in getting more information. St. John Hunt, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Look forward to listening to your shows. I'm an avid Coast to Coast listener. When I have a chance, I always tune in and listen to you guys. You're great.
Hey, well, I hope you and I can talk off the air. I'd like to have a further conversation, but thanks for being on the program. Thanks to all of our callers and my folks there, Gina and Nathan and Lex and Dan Galandi at Premier, and I'll be back next Sunday night. Good night, everyone.